We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall never surrender until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of people.
In times of universal deceit, truth is the only rebellion left. As we enter into the final stretch of this election season, we need to be asking ourselves, what is our highest good? What is that value that we hold most dear as a nation? What is our summum bonum? We go to Ronald Reagan, Winston Churchill, Edmund Burke, and Michael Ramsden for the answer. I'm Dr. Everett Piper, and this is The Rebellion. Welcome to today's edition of The Rebellion. What is your highest good? What is that value that you hold most dear? What is your top priority? What value do you hold that trumps all other values? We all should be able to answer that question. When push comes to shove, which values rise to the top and which values are going to become secondary to that primary ultimate good? We've talked about it before. Go back to your freshman year philosophy class, philosophy 101, if you will. We talked about the summum bonum. That is the human being's highest good. And as we go into this final stretch of the election season, this last couple of weeks, as you're deciding how to vote, and as you're talking to your neighbors and your relatives about the same, we need to have those conversations. We need to be able to resolve those questions within ourselves and within our families as to what is the top priority. That priority should drive everything else. It's the engine to the train. All the other priorities are cars being towed by that engine. So today we will talk about that highest good. I'm going to argue that we are a schizophrenic culture that is divided and torn between two competing priorities, highest goods. On one side, you have the call for safety and comfort, coddling. You have this cry for safe spaces and this demand that we be safe even from diseases. And on the other side, we have the call for freedom and liberty. So on one side, safety and comfort. On the other side, we have freedom and liberty. Endemic to the side of comfort is very little risk because you can't be hurt if you're totally safe. On the other side, freedom comes with risk, and it comes with the potential of pain. We'll talk about this in today's show. We're going to go back and talk about the story of Michael Ramsden of the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics. I'm going to go to Winston Churchill again and explain to you why I use his speech as the lead into this show. We'll talk about Edmund Burke and one of his famous quotes. And yes, we're going to go back to one of the greatest speeches in recent American history, and that is from the great communicator Ronald Reagan in 1964. Before we get into all of that, remember that if you want to subscribe to The Rebellion, you can do so by going to patreon.com/Dr. Everett Piper, DrEverettPiper. patreon.com/Dr. Everett Piper. To support The Rebellion, subscribe to it, and to help us continue this particular voice and this particular ministry in a culture that I would argue is desperately in need of at least the conversation. Some of the conversations that we circle around, some of the ideas that we don't run away from, but actually we run toward them. We're not afraid of them, we actually embrace them, whether we agree with them or not. Again, that's the nature of being a classical liberal. I told you several weeks ago, maybe it was over 2 months ago, I can't remember now. It's been a long time. I shared with you at the front end of the COVID situation, so it was probably back in February or March, the story of Michael Ramsden. And his analogy that he used in trying to help people understand what the priorities during this COVID pandemic and crisis are, what those priorities, what those competing priorities are, and what our values should be in times of crisis, what the human being should hold most dear. He painted this picture. He said, let's suppose that through our superior technology today that all of the Silicon Valley moguls have invented artificial intelligence at the level that we could actually program robots via AI, artificial intelligence, to conduct and to perform one specific task. And that one task would be make sure that all human beings are safe, always safe. And let's assume that as we've programmed these AI robots to do that and to perform that function, that they quickly figure out, because of the superior programming of all the geniuses from Silicon Valley, that the best way to keep human beings safe is to take us and put us in 10 by 10 foot cubicles, 10 feet underground, and feed us intravenously with purified food and pump in sanitized air. We'd be free from any contamination whatsoever. There'd be all the filters to keep us safe. We couldn't get in an automobile accident because we can't get in automobiles. We couldn't get in a plane crash because you won't ever even know what a plane is. You can't get a disease because you're not exposed to any germs, any viruses. You're safe. And let's assume that just because these robots have figured out how to do this for the human race, that they extend our average lifespan up to, let's say, we all live to 95 or 100 years of age. What a wonderful thing. We're safe, and we live to nearly 100. Michael Ramsden pauses and says, is that what you want? Is that what human beings are for? Now, I hope we can answer, well, of course not. That's an extreme scenario. But as we cry for safety all the time, and ignore the liberties that we're forfeiting for the sake of that safety, shouldn't we be asking ourselves these questions that Ramsden forces us to confront as he paints this picture for us? You know, back when I did my Not a Daycare tour, when I had my 15 minutes of fame because I dared to call out the snowflakes on our college campuses, and you know the story, I said, if you want to be coddled rather than confronted, if you want us to make you feel comfortable rather than to challenge you, then go someplace else. This is not a safe place, but a place to learn. I'll repeat that. I said this is not a safe place, but a place to learn, because learning is not always safe. So don't be crying to me about your safe spaces and your microaggressions and your trigger warnings, your critical race theory, and the fact that you're offended all the time by somebody else's words, or even just by somebody else. And then I concluded by saying, this is a university, it's not a daycare. Grow up. When I went on my tour on Fox and Friends and Fox News and Glenn Beck and, oh, Huckabee Show, the 700 Club, Adam Carolla, Dave Rubin, Tucker Carlson Show, the list goes on, Bill O'Reilly. When I went on my little tour of 15 minutes of fame, I was asked over and over again by these media elites, these talking heads, these very well-known people. They would ask me the question, well, how do these students think they're going to be able to function in the real world? Once they leave the ivory tower, once they leave the college and university, they can't act this way any longer. They're going to have to function like adults. This cry for safety just isn't going to work when they go to work for IBM or Microsoft or Apple or Google or ConocoPhillips or Exxon. It's not going to work. And here's what I think those people missed when they asked me that question. It will work in the minds of those students that exist at Berkeley and Brown right now, because as soon as they leave Berkeley and go to IBM, they're going to carry that same worldview with them. And all of a sudden, they're not 21-year-olds any longer that are pouting and prancing and preening in the college green. They're 31-year-olds who have a lot of power and authority to force their entire company to bow to the cry for safety. And that's exactly what you see right now in our culture. It is that college attitude, that collegiate attitude, that adolescent temper tantrum that you saw at Berkeley and Brown is now running the streets of America from Minneapolis, Indianapolis, Baltimore, and Boston in the form of Black Lives Matter and the screaming for safe spaces. Don't offend me. Don't make me uncomfortable. How dare you challenge my views, my ideas. You have made me feel bad, and therefore you need to be silenced. That's the nature of the debate today. And that's what we're going to confront after we take a break right now. We're going to go back to Reagan, Churchill, Burke, and maybe a couple others. I'm Dr. Everett Piper, and this is The Rebellion. We'll take a break for a couple minutes to acknowledge our sponsors, and we'll be right back. So welcome back to The Rebellion. This cry for safety. Do we want to be a safe people, or do we want to be a free people? I mean, this is something that we're having to wrestle with right now. You know, it used to be self-evident that we were the land of the free, not the land of the safe. That the Statue of Liberty stood on our eastern shores, not the Statue of Safety. That Patrick Henry said, give me liberty or give me death, not I fear death, so take my liberty. But now all of these statements of liberty serving as the summum bonum, the highest good for our country and our culture, seem to be called into question by the demand that we be safe. We're standing on the edge of a cliff right now, and we're looking over the edge, and we've got to decide if we're going to follow this slippery slope over the precipice of wanting to be safe, and therefore selling out our souls and our entire culture for the sake of something that just yesterday, 5 minutes ago, would have been admitted to be an inferior value rather than the highest good. Let's go back to the great communicator, 1964. I'm going to read part of this speech that you all know. Maybe some of you have it committed to memory. Today we are at war, and if we lose, history will record with the greatest astonishment that those who had the most to lose did the least to prevent its happening. We have come to a time for choosing. Either we accept the responsibility for our own destiny, or we abandon the American Revolution and confess that those in a far distant capital can plan our lives far better for us than we can plan them for ourselves. Already the hour is late. We are being asked to buy our safety by selling into permanent slavery and giving up our freedom because we are ready to make a deal with our slave masters. Alexander Hamilton warned us that a nation which can prefer disgrace to danger is prepared for a master and deserves one. Admittedly, there is a risk in any course we follow. Choosing the high road cannot eliminate that risk. Already some of the architects of our safety have hinted what their decision will be if their plan fails. They believe it is better for us to live on our knees than to die on our feet. If we are to believe that nothing is worth the dying, when did this begin? Should Moses have told the children of Israel to live in slavery rather than dare the wilderness? Should Christ have refused the cross? Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have refused? Let me go back. Should the patriots at Concord Bridge have refused to fire the shot heard round the world? Are we to believe that all the martyrs of history died in vain? And then Reagan concludes, you and I have a rendezvous with destiny. We can preserve for our children this last best hope of man on earth, or we can sentence them to take the first step into 1,000 years of darkness. If we fail, at least our children and our children's children say of us, we justified our brief moment here and did all that could be done. Ronald Reagan, 1964. The history of the United States is grounded in this long fight for freedom. That's evident. I mean, we fought wars not for safety, but for freedom. The Revolutionary War was a battle for what? Freedom. The Civil War was a battle for freedom. We sacrificed the lives of thousands and thousands of our young men in both World Wars, I and II, for what? For freedom. None of these wars, none of these conflicts and these battles were safe, but they were worth fighting because of the highest good that we held, freedom. Human liberty. Freedom. You know, it's reported that Dwight Eisenhower once said this, if you want security, go to prison. At least there you're fed and clothed and given medical care and so on. The only thing lacking is freedom. So, if you want security, go to prison. You get everything you need. Food and clothes and hospital care. The only thing lacking is liberty, freedom. Or, to paraphrase Alexander Hamilton, which Ronald Reagan just quoted, if you prefer safety for freedom, then be prepared for a master. Because you deserve one and you'll get one. So in November, remember the words of Reagan. Remember these words. We all have a rendezvous with destiny. And are you going to vote? Am I going to vote? Are we going to encourage our family members and those that we have influence over to vote for safety? Are we going to vote for safety? Or will we vote for freedom, the freedom promised to us in the American experiment by our founding fathers who pledged their honor and their fortunes, pledged their lives to give us what we have today because their safety in their minds was not even close to the top priority. They wanted to leave their posterity, their children, and their children's children a nation that was free. Not one that was just safe. Churchill. I start out every show. You've heard it. If you've listened to the show, you've heard it a dozen times or however many times you've chosen to follow the rebellion. I'm going to read the words of Churchill that I use to start every show. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall never surrender until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to rescue and to liberate the old. Churchill. We don't need a Chamberlain today. We need Churchill's. Chamberlain thought appeasement, safety for Great Britain was enough. And Churchill said, no, no, safety, appeasement is not enough. We must be a free people. We cannot bow the knee to the Nazi regime. And he said, we shall fight. I've told you the story before of the Chronicles of Narnia. And how when I was a dad, still am a dad, but when I was a young dad and my boys were little, I probably did a lot of things that were wrong as a father, but the one thing I think I did right was every night, regardless of how tired I was and how worn out I might have been from a day at work, I would always put the boys to bed and I would read to them a regular story, is what we called it, and a Bible story. And then we'd pray, and the boys would go to bed. So the regular story nightly and the Bible story. Well, the regular story took on it could be whatever. I read Les Miserables to them. Yeah, it was the abridged version, but at least you give me credit. I read Les Mis to the boys when they were 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. William Bennett's Book of Virtues and all the various different parables, poems. Great book, by the way. You should get your kids and your grandkids. I read Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings, but the one series that we read over and over again over those years was C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia. I bet I read those 7 books of that series at least 7 times over throughout the course of my boys growing up. Now, there's one story in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. It's the story when the Pevensey children, the English children, first discover Narnia. And you know how it goes. They're playing in their uncle's grand mansion. And they go upstairs playing hide-and-seek. And Lucy, the younger girl, the younger sister, goes into a wardrobe, a closet. And in that closet, there's lots of old clothes, fur coats, and whatnot. And as she's hiding in the closet from her brothers and her sister, she turns around to face the back, and the back's not there. All of a sudden, she pushes the fur coats aside, and she enters into the grand, mysterious land of Narnia, the snow-filled hills and snow-covered fern trees. She enters into the lands, a land of fauns and tree nymphs and dryads and centaurs. And while she's there, She also meets the talking animals. And 2 of the talking animals are Mr. and Mrs. Beaver. So Lucy's there now, and she's gone back, and she's got her brothers and sisters, and they're all visiting Narnia. They're trying to figure out what it's all about. And they're starting to hear stories from the various different creatures, the talking animals as well as the other characters that I've mentioned, the fauns and the centaurs. But Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, as they're describing Narnia to the children, tell them that the rumor is that Aslan is on the loose and that winter is going to melt and springtime will come. And the children ask, well, who's Aslan? And they're told by Mr. and Mrs. Beaver, well, don't you know Aslan is the son of the great emperor beyond the sea? Aslan is the great lion. And the children are confused and they start to get frightened because they don't know how to react to this lion that's being described to them. So they turn to Mr. and Mrs. Beaver and they ask this question. Well, is Aslan safe? Is Aslan safe? And Mr. Beaver guffaws and says, well, of course not. Of course not. Aslan isn't safe, but he's good. There's a huge difference between safety and goodness. The great lion Aslan is not safe, but he's good. The great lion Christ, the Lion of Judah, is not safe, but he's good. And if we could paraphrase that, the great lion of liberty, of freedom, is not safe, but it's good. There's a huge difference between safety and goodness. One should be your highest priority and the other should be second to it. Safety isn't necessarily bad, but it can't be the train that drives all others because you forfeit freedom in the process if all you care about is safety. Freedom, liberty, has to drive a culture, a country, a church, a college, a company. Without it, everybody is going to be held in bondage to power, whoever happens to have the most of it at any given time. The great lion of liberty isn't safe, but it is good. It's worth fighting for and defending. And that is the one thing that should drive your vote. Period. Which party, which candidate will give you more freedom at the end of the day? More religious freedom, more economic freedom, more intellectual and academic freedom, more freedom to raise your family as you see fit, more freedom to keep your money rather than to give it to someone else or some other entity, more freedom to teach your children what their values should be, what their summum bonum should be. Which party, which candidate will give you more freedom? There's another quote from Winston Churchill. You know this one too. Here it is. This is the lesson. Never give in. Never give in. Never give in. Never, 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 never. In nothing, great or small, large or petty, never give in. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy. Winston Churchill, 1941. After defeating Hitler. This is the lesson. Never give in, never give in, never, 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 and nothing great or small, large or petty. Never give in. Never yield to force. Never yield to the apparently overwhelming might of the enemy. This is our time. I said in yesterday's show, you know the end of the story. You've read the end of the book. You know who wins. Christ has promised us that the gates of hell, the very gates of hell, hell itself cannot defeat the obedient body of Christ, his church. I'm not worried about the outcome. What I'm concerned about is, can I stand before the great lion of Judah and say, I fought for the freedom that you gave me? Or am I going to have to bow my head in shame and say, I forfeited that freedom all for the sake of safety because I wanted to be comfortable. I didn't want to get sick. I didn't want to take a risk. You know, Mordecai came to Esther at a time of great crisis, and he said to Esther, "Who knows but that God has chosen you for such a time as this?" Maybe that's a great way to end today's show. Who knows but that God has chosen you and me for such a time as this? This is our time. It's our rendezvous with destiny. Well, maybe I won't close with that. Maybe I'll close with this. Edmund Burke: "The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." Sit on the sidelines, do nothing, and evil can triumph, at least in the short term. Is that what you want to leave your children and your children's children? Is that the memory you want them to have of you? The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for you to do nothing. I'm Dr. Everett Piper, and this is The Rebellion.